When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
Parents, when you visit California, childhood rules. If you don't remember how awesome childhood is, just ask yourself,
what would kids do?
Let childhood rule your family vacation. Start planning your trip to the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Yep. Okay. 1, 2, 3. I made an ass of that, so I did.
I went way too early. Yeah, it's totally jazz clapping.
I wish I were recording because we could have kept this in.
We'll do a 3-2-1 clap, okay? Yeah. I'll count it in, right? Let's see how we can get on with this. 3-2-1 jackpot.
Jeez. Okay. Hi, you're listening to the Unsung Podcast. This is the second time we've done this intro. my name is Mark. I'm joined by two very questionable looking men with interesting haircuts and a lovely guest this week.
Opposite me is H from Steps. He's kind of I, Jai, and K now, I think. But
on to the right of my screen is Gary Barlow.
Oh dear.
I've done all right for myself.
And this week we're joined by a guest. We're joined by Katie Jane Garside from many projects. Daisy Chainsaw, Queen Adrena, Ruby Throat, and more recently, literally like a week ago, The Lyre Flower as well.
Yeah,
so, Katie Jane, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm very happy that we managed to find our way here.
It's not been a total shambles so far.
No.
Speaking of finding our way here, Katie Jane, can you tell us where you are? Because that's going to be a really interesting feature of this conversation generally, I think.
Well, we're on a boat on the south coast, Cornwall, near Falmouth. And but actually, I when we were talking, I figured that it was going to be really noisy on the boat, and I can't sort of predict what will happen, and there's people living there too in a very small space. So I am actually in a room on the land at a friend's abode talking to you.
And my boat. You were surfing, is that right?
Yeah, we just went to North Coast to get some waves. Bit of late summer immersion. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, but I meant that I was late for a very important date, but not too late.
Have you got something on after this, or is there something coming up?
I just
got
to swim back to the boat.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I missed my lift. They've gone. My little girl. Yes, Bill.
As well as being a musician, you are something of a seafarer, right? Clearly, when I was listening to you a few years ago now, I had no idea that the history you had with the sea is not just something that you've taken up recently. As I understand, you were born in Yorkshire, is that right? But you spent a lot of time at sea as a child. Could you tell us a wee bit about that? Because it's definitely informative later on.
Yes, of course. Yes. Well, I come from very nomadic people. For generations have lived overseas, and my dad was actually in the army and in the SAS, which took us far and wide, but that's been gone back for generations and generations. And so they, always had an eye on the horizon. And when I was, I remember sitting in the bath talking to my dad when I was 6 years old, and he asked me if I wanted to sail around the world, and I said I did if we could call the boat Silver Seaweed. And that came to pass. I went to boarding school at 9, and then they took me out at 11, and we went sailing around the world once he'd made the money that we needed to in Saudi Arabia after he'd left the SAS shipping or running a trucking company. Yeah, and so we got the money together to buy a small boat, and it was a very small boat. It was 33 feet and had no radio or comms of any kind. And we went off sailing around the world with my little sister, Mel. And that took us 2 years, and spent a lot of time at sea because we had to get round. 2 years is very fast to sail around the world in a small boat, because small boats don't go that fast. And we did that, and that was the beginning of, that was a utopia actually for me after boarding school, which was a kind of trip into the underworld, into hell really. So I had very contrasting things from 9 to 14, really.
Yeah, wow. I mean, to go from the relative isolation and the very small sort of nuclear family environment to a boarding school, how did you fit in at school? Did you feel quite kind of on the periphery, or did you make friends fairly readily?
Boarding school was really hard, and I think it was really hard on most children that were there. And, my own daughter right now is 9 years old, and it's quite an extraordinary thing to think about, sending that little person off at that age. I think no one's equipped for that, and certain personalities do thrive, but most do not. And I ended up going there in midterm as well. I joined midterm, where the sort of the hierarchies had been established. So I think I found it very difficult to integrate from there. It was quite honestly quite an unfortunate. The whole thing was quite unfortunate. It's funny because I've been at peace with it for many years, but now that my daughter's 9, it's quite raw again. It was quite savage. Yes, I remember being dropped off and all my things piled on this sort of little tiny sort of hospital bed. And then for some reason leaving the dormitory and coming back and finding all my stuff thrown around the room, everything pulled out of my trunk packing case, and everything just sort of destroyed. And that was my entry into that environment. But some very beautiful things happened there too, because it was set in it's a beautiful kind of walled prison, really. But there was a baby fox used to come and visit us in the wild places, and we were allowed into the wild places. We were so, this very young. It's very curious when you think about that. 9 year olds.
So obviously you went on to do quite a bit of touring in your projects later in life, and this is maybe an unusual take. I'm sure it's something that's occurred to you over the years, but do you think that sort of nomadic lifestyle in any way made the touring a bit less of a shock to your system? Because I do know that people that are used to very settled lives find touring very, very difficult often. And do you feel you were any better equipped?
Yeah, I think so. I used to love it, you know, getting on to... actually, I won't pretend I loved all of it because a lot of it was... But no, I did. I loved the whole thing of being in a band and what that really made sense to me and always has done. In a sense, I've always been in a band and had that very close... what's the word I'm looking for? Symbiotic relationships in my life that I really don't look outside of. So it is as if, you know, it's a boat life where, to use an unfortunate phrase, you're as strong as the weakest link in the chain. You know, we're all so symbiotic. And I found touring... Yeah, getting onto my tour boat, very particularly when they became a bit nicer, you know, when there was some money involved later on in Daisy Chainsaw, particularly where there, I think a bit in Queen Adrena as well, where you actually did have a little bit more than a transit van with the amps falling on you, you know. that kind of touring in the dead of winter is quite hard. That has suited me, and you know, here I am at this age, and I continue. I've done the same thing my whole life, basically, from 18 years old onwards.
Katie Jane, one thing that I was sort of thinking about and taken by in terms of your life on the boat between 11 and 14 was that you were sort of there were no distractions. You didn't even have, you know, communication with other radio, and I guess you were doing some schoolwork and stuff like that, but in many ways it kind of feels like the ultimate lockdown.
Absolutely.
Like, how would you say have you seen sort of reflections of your time on the boat compared to now, the last few months, when sort of day-to-day life has been taken away?
Yeah, for us, it made, you know, the person it impacted is my daughter. Mm-hmm. Chris and I, no change. And, you know, all that stuff happened for me at such a formative age, that isolation, we can be like 42 days crossing an ocean where literally it's just you and a tiny, in 33 feet of space, six feet wide. And that really is what, at that young age, you know, that created those synaptic connections for me. From my own, you know, I don't like the word process, but I'll use it. For my own process to become a writer, well, I don't even like, no, I wouldn't call myself a writer either. But I made dolls, made rag dolls, and the stories came out of the rag dolls, and there's nowhere, you know, I didn't have to do any kind of leap to become the doll in my later life and have the stories come through me. Yeah, so all that came from that isolation, and in terms of the lockdown that we've all just been involved in, it's very, very, nothing new, but also we were incredibly privileged where we had outside space. We weren't on the boat for the lockdown. So, you know, we live lived in a wild place in Cornwall, and were able to sort of continue. So I'm eternally grateful and fortunate for that. I know it is not so, or was not so for others.
Can I ask, when did the music come into your life? I mean, on the boat, is this after, were your family musical at all? When did that become just a key ingredient? Because it clearly went on to be a huge part of your life.
Yeah, well, so in, I know I always loved to sing, and that just was. And I heard Christmas plays with my cousins and things like that, just making stuff up on the spot. I heard my aunt whispering, "Oh, she, you know, she can sing," and that went into me. I grabbed that at probably, I don't know, six or seven, And but then when we were on the boat, yes, we made these dolls and we were listening to tapes all the time of musicals of My Fair Lady and The Sound of Music and Oklahoma and Carousel and West Side Story and Led Zeppelin and The Beatles and Pink Floyd and that was just, you know, those on wobbly old tapes, just, that was our soundtrack. And with my sister and I totally absorbed those and reinterpreted the stories of those musicals and things.
A boat must be a good place to practice screaming as well, Katie Jane.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I didn't do any of that, I have to say, because it is a really confined space. I did that later on up in the Lake District. That was later. I do get confused. The timelines always get mixed up because obviously I found that light switch in Daisy Chainsaw that just went on. As I went on, walked on stage because that was just so utterly terrifying. There was a catalytic switch just flipped and...
So was that a way of dealing with the anxiety, do you think?
I think it was a result of, as a result of the terror. And it was also the zeitgeist of the time, the grime of those venues and the bands that were around. I'd like to think it was all me, but, I'm solipsistic by nature in my outlook, but I would have been carried by that wave, surfing that wave.
I've seen you say in interviews you actually were quite self-deprecating, describing sort of suggesting you were an imitator and like you absorbed other influences and sort of reappropriated them and maybe playing down your own level of innovation. I felt what is your outlook on that? Because I mean, I don't get that from you. I mean, there are comparisons. I'm sure you're sick to the back teeth of people mentioning things like PG Harvey or Kate Bush. But I mean, certainly the music I heard of yours was before I heard music by PG Harvey. But I don't know, like, how do you view your own identity in that? Because it seems to me, as an onlooker, that you have quite a strong identity, but you don't seem to feel you do.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. You know, somebody said to me the other day, how did you arrive so fully formed? And I had no concept of that. But if I look at Daisy Chainsaw stuff, and I am always I can have possibly a tiny bit of separation from it at this point. I think inevitably looking through the eyes is a subjective experience, but I can pretend to have a bit of objectivity, and that person does look quite fully formed. And I don't really have an explanation for that. But again, when I see people that age now, I'm always so shocked and surprised at the self-assurance, and it's almost an arrogance of youth. And I think as possibly as you get older and as life happens to you, perhaps one begins to question a bit more, and perhaps sort of holes begin to form in the identity. I mean, I never had sense of self, I will always say that, but I am quite shocked to see how fully formed that person in Daisy Chainsaw looks, actually. I said to you, Chris, previously, I was aware of some sort of the phrasing of Bjork creeping in some little bits, and I was aware of that very quickly and didn't want that, and so made a real conscious decision to not really listen to anything But nowadays, you know, when I started writing on my own at this late sort of stage, I the most thing I sort of hear is the sort of the lilt of those voices, like Doris Day or something like that. Those kind of phrasings come out, and that would have been from the really early influences of boat times.
So you've mentioned Daisy Chainsaw, and just for the benefit of listeners that aren't as familiar, Daisy Chainsaw, you started in 1989 with Crispin Gray, is that right? Mm-hmm. You answered an advert, I believe.
Yes.
What made you answer the advert?
Well, I had a very peculiar thing happen when I believe I was 15 or 16. I'd made a tape. I just made a tape to tape on a boom box thing in my mum and dad's house, and I'd had a tape of Stevie Nicks singing. Oh my God, I've forgotten the song. Singing one of her very, very well-known songs, and I was singing with her, over her, onto the other tape, through the air, and my sister took that tape away to, she was poor angel, sent to boarding school. I refused to go when we came back from seeing around the world, but we had no money, we had 50 quid and a boat, and so my dad went out to Saudi Arabia again to make some money, and she took that tape with her, and she was playing it in the dormitory, and one of her friend's father walked in and asked her who it was singing, and that was Glyn Johns, who's a record producer who's done everybody. I heard the other day he'd done Bob Dylan as well. I didn't realise that at the time. And he invited me to come and sing with his... for his son, who's Ethan Johns, also a record producer, and we were the same age. I think I was a couple of months older than Ethan. So we ended up for the next year, or any time I could, getting the train to Horsham, to their sort of huge 24-track recording studio, and just playing, you know, being children in a huge recording studio, writing songs and getting together as, you know, girl and boy. And that was, you know, at the time I didn't sort of realise the significance of that. Anyway, Ethan and I were about to run away to LA and become rock stars, and then he broke up with me as all 16 or 16 year olds do and should do. And so I was suddenly like, oh, I'd quitted a scholarship I had to do art at Cramer. And I just thought, I went to London and I was living in squats, doing really weird jobs that didn't make any money, of selling life insurance to boxers on council estates. Commission based. I didn't sell any life insurance. No one bought any off me. And I answered an ad in the Melody Maker, and angry and determined because I'd been dumped. And, you know, my big break had fallen apart. I wasn't in LA being a rock star, and I think possibly maybe that's where that sort of. I only recently realised that where the sort of catalyst for the explosion happened probably was that. I'm probably boarding school, you know, I had a whole bag of resentments on my back. I answered an ad that Crispin placed, and I answered it. I just found him to be the most strange person I could imagine. But he wanted me. He was very persistent, and... I was 18, I think, by the time we got into the rehearsal studio. And I think we ended up doing that for a couple of years before we, you know, I really didn't want to play a show. I was just doing it because I didn't know what else to do. And I was not convinced. not remotely convinced that this was a good idea. But we sort of, you know, one something about Crispin is he's incredibly cut as sharp as his cheekbones, and he knows exactly what he wants and where he's going. And yeah, very, very focused. And something made as over time, something in that gave us that arrogance and self-belief. Yeah, and we were very, again, very fortunate, or not, as the case may be, that the first gig I believe that we did at the Bull and Gate got reviewed very, very healthily in the Melody Maker by Jonathan Seltzer, who is a friend of Crispin's, at that they worked some, you know, rubbish job at, that meant they were cleaning or breaking down piping to sort of unblock sewage and things like that, and they were the handy guys, the back room boys. Anyway,
it's not the rock scene in LA, is it?
Well, it's Charing Cross Road, you know. They but you know, that guy also made it seem like it was just so easy to do it, which probably did give us a sort of false sense of arrogance, which I think probably fueled the whole thing along. And I remember people accusing us of that we seemed like we'd been constructed, like it was some kind of record company idea putting us together, but it wasn't. There was just a series of events that gave us a sort of, I don't know, just led us by the nose, really. And we were just pushing through. We pushed and pushed, and yeah, everything was ripe for that moment in time. Yeah, and those things happen rarely, but it did happen, so.
Now, you and Crispin have made a formidable team over the years, because you obviously joined up again for Queen Adrena. But with Daisy Chainsaw, you did a couple of early EPs, and then you did the debut album at 11-teen, which came out in 92. I think the first place I saw you was on I think it was ITV chart show, but then I also saw your Word performance, you know, staying up late hoping my parents couldn't hear that the TV was on. And you did Love Your Money, which was like the breakout single for the band at the time.
Yeah.
I believe you were also, at one point, you were meant to appear on Top of the Pops, but you couldn't because of a throat infection. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you look back in that? Would you have liked to have done that?
I think we refused to do it because they wouldn't let us play live, and I had so we had to make polite excuses. But I think we were then got banned by the BBC because of that, or something like that. I'm told, I think. But yeah, so I was going to have to overdub, and I was allowed to be live. That was it, live vocal overdubbing to a backing track, and I just remember feeling that would make me feel so exposed. Yeah. Because the whole thing was that kind of explosion out of a can, and you know, if somebody offered me that now, I would probably do it.
that was definitely their modus operandi then, because I remember watching Nirvana doing the same thing, and he sang it all in the baritone to try and mock it. So I believe Daisy Chainsaw was courted by Maverick, though, is that right? Madonna's label, but you chose to go with One Little Indian. Were you happy with that choice in hindsight? What was your experience like?
I mean... Honestly, it is really hard to sort of dial back to that. I was happy with One Little Indian, very, very much so. And, you know, Derek Burkett is his dream, his thing. He's been so good to me through all the years. He's always taken my calls, put it that way, and he's always given me whatever I need to do what I need to do, and I'll be, you know, he's really has been an enabler, champion, whatever. He's been there for me my whole life, and I do really appreciate that. And he's been hard with me as well. Like those, and now I say that as one project that he wouldn't bite onto, probably with good reason. But you know, when I was gonna go. I went off around the country to go. I ended up in the Lake District with my DAT recorder up mountains doing that screaming we referred to earlier to make this sort of elemental record. He just wrote me a check and went, yeah, okay, I'll fund that with. And I did indeed take the check and spend the money and didn't deliver a record, you know. So he keeps doing that for me.
That's pretty rock and roll.
It is cool. He's very good to me. Yeah.
So I mean, at the kind of height of the kind of cult value of Daisy Chainsaw, you toured with Nine Inch Nails, is that right? And Hole, I believe.
Toured with Hole. I don't remember touring with Nine Inch Nails. Maybe I pretend I did, but no, I don't. I think I did something. I think it was the Long Weekend or something where I think they were the headline. Okay. I think that's what it was. Yeah. Gotcha.
I know Courtney went on record as saying at the time that alongside herself and Cap Yelland, you were some of the originators of the Riot Girl spirit, if not necessarily the sort of North Pacific Northwest actual movement. How do you feel about those comments? Do you think that's relevant? We did an episode on Riot Girl and you came up during that actually. But I'm curious what your take on that is.
Well, Courtney Love, you know, she's just a force of nature and I adore her, and I'll take her word for it. Yeah, that's fine, that's cool.
Do you have fond recollections of those tours?
Yeah, I'm glad I was there. I don't remember very much at all. I just remember her kind of quite lit. She was lit, very lit from within, and incredibly powerful and terrifying. And you know, I couldn't really meet her gaze. She's phenomenal. And when you see footage of her, the power that comes off her. Yeah, I do remember, I think it was that tour. I think it was a Barrowlands gig that, again, it's really, I got a kind of snapshot of, I don't know if it was that tour, but it was a Barrowlands gig, and it was one of those shows where it all, where you I'm not sure I had the word for it right now, but where it all...
Everything clicks?
Yeah, that will do. But it's where I'm not singing, where I'm being sung. It's that thing, the
okay.
So, you know, you talk about it in meditation, where are you become the universe, or become everything boundless, without edges. And that happened, and I became the room, the audience, the walls. And that's it's the place we're all trying to get to. But you can't try to get there, actually. That's the paradox. Sometimes, the floor falls away and the screen turns into fractals and... anyway, that happened. But so, yeah, no, I don't have really... I have Courtney Litt, I remember her, in some uncharacteristically red trousers. And,
There's another thing I have to ask you about now that I've got you here. There's a standout, bizarre interview with a guy called Paul Morley from 1992 that's quite frequently shared online.
I have, actually. Do you like that picture?
It's risque, isn't it?
Are you risque, Kate?
I don't, not consciously, no. No, again...
You show a lot of yourself, don't you?
No, I don't.
Not enough, Anthony.
What?
Not enough.
No, I do. I talk too much.
Can you read my mind?
Paul,
First of all, what was your take on that interview? And was that typical? Because it's the attitude of the interviewer is so strange. But I noticed that in a number of the articles of the time, people may say, oh, it was 25 years ago, but there's still a kind of weird, latent patronising misogyny to a lot of the comments that I saw journalists making. Was that your impression at the time, or am I reading too much into that?
I think there was a journalist, Everett True, who, you know, it's funny, it seemed so important at the time, but he determinedly not my friend, you know, had every opportunity, and that was hard to take.
Yeah, he was quite closely affiliated with Nirvana, wasn't he? He did the
Yeah, he was, and he loved Courtney. I'm not sure about Paul. I remember the Pink Staircase. That's my, and I was trying to move on it, but it was kind of sucking me into it, and that. I couldn't get any traction on the Pink Staircase because it was made of sort of foam that was enveloping me. That's my memory from now.
Wow. So in 1993, you left Daisy Chainsaw prior to their second album. It's also interestingly, I think, the period at which alt rock was really exploding. I mean, by about 93, 94, bands were getting signed up pretty readily. I don't want to say do you regret it, but I mean, do you think that Daisy Chainsaw would have been in a position to ride that wave had you stayed? I mean, I don't think it's entirely disrespectful to say they lost something when you went. How do you feel about that looking back in it with a bit of hindsight?
You know, if there had been, well, okay, let's go to the core of it. Crispin and I have a really hard time working together. That's the core of it. And I wish it wasn't so. I wish, but there's something, you know, it is what makes it and it's what breaks it, as it is in many of those co-writing relationships. Mm-hmm. If it would have been possible to go on, I would have done. And I would have loved to have done. But the relationship was so, so really difficult to manage for both of us. It was so, you know, as we got older and into Queen of Drina, it's a long time later. Well, not that long. Oh no, it was a bit. We did manage to manage it slightly better, but ultimately not really. If there had been someone that could have mentored us, that would have been really helpful. But it was so hard, Chris, and I wish it hadn't been, and because I know there's a power there between us, something that fires rockets, but it's really unmanageable. Ultimately, it's making me want to cry.
It's so hard
to manage that, and it's rare that you are in that position where you have that opportunity, honestly, where it does work so well. That's a very rare thing, but it really was unmanageable. And it had taken me to, I felt so sort of ransacked, really.
I mean, it must be a weird push and pull when you're that productive as a duo, as the later collaboration showed as well, but yet there is that tension. That must be a strange.
Well, I wasn't writing at that point, and I always felt terribly ashamed of that. I felt, because I couldn't be for real if I wasn't writing that material. So the way I owned it was by producing it and destroying it. And I can take credit for that, but as much as I, that was the key to the relationship. He was writing it and I was destroying it. And that was really hard on him, and that was really hard on me. It all sounds so dramatic, and I realise that it does as I'm saying it now. And I don't want to be self-indulgent. But that is the key to it, and the key is, because I didn't necessarily want to live my whole life under a leaf, being someone that works in the shadows. My ego was wanting to keep climbing the mountain, but I was also really, really done in by the expectation and the responsibility and the having to show up every night and go on tour for months, years at a time. With children, I was like 21, 22 years old, and that's really the physicality on the body, let alone the mind, is immense. So, but it's all just a bit fun as well. You have to keep it real.
So see, as much as perhaps your upbringing and that kind of nomadic and very small nuclear family unit sort of maybe equipped you better than some for being in the road, do you think it maybe put you at a disadvantage with those kind of like conflict resolution situations where there were other personalities involved that weren't family?
We ended up in a very strange place where it was me on my own, and the band really very, really cross with me. I think because actually I was really trying to control that thing, particularly in the studio. When it came to live, it's everyone for themselves all together. Mm-hmm. But in the studio, I was very controlling about it needing to go more, or rip the bass speaker to get a shredded sound, things like that, or speed it up or slow it down, but do it there and then. So something like I hope all your dreams come true. That had been a fast song, and I made them all play it really slowly in a dirge in the studio, and everyone's really mad at me about that, and hating me. But I'm totally not accepting that. And I was very fortunate at that time to find Ken Thomas, who was worked with us as a producer on that record, and he stood the ground with me, and he was the closest thing that came to a mentor, and he really was really a really good friend to both Crispin and I. We both are really passionate about Ken, but even with Ken, and Ken even toured with us, he did sound for us live, and again he made things sane and safe for me, because no one else could. They just saw me as someone that was destroying things.
Were you literally slashing speakers? Is that
yes,
an actual thing?
Yes, we were literally ripping the paper cones.
That does explain that amazing tone.
Yeah, it does.
So it sounds like quite a, I don't want to say stressful, because that maybe makes it sound excessively negative, but it took a toll, and you stepped away almost completely for about 6 years, quite famously. Now, you perhaps don't want to discuss that period, but it's a little bit of a mystery in terms of people's understanding of you as an artist. It's sort of 6 years of, where's Katie Jane? Where is she gone?
Yeah, yeah. Happy to talk about it. No, it was it was a beautiful time. I went to Derek, and he wrote me a check for £12,000 to drive off to the Lake District to go and make an elemental thing. And I'd found this thing so early on. The words, shamanism kind of spoke to me, and I went off and lived with people, with about 20 people living in a room and living in the woods as well, doing shamanic journeying and soul retrieval and all these beautiful, beautiful things that took me in deep, and I was meditating. was a beauty. I found, you know, I was able to begin to write songs and gather no identity of self, but with the bits that I had, begin to be able to tell, you know, a story. And the fact that I ran into Crispin again is a strange thing, actually.
Was it totally unplanned?
Well, it was totally unplanned that he ended up living in the same part of London that I did. And, you know, I always loved Crispin and, you know, I was excited to see him again. But we're very wary of each other. But he asked me if I wanted to sing this song that he'd found called Pretty Polly, the traditional song. But we did do that, and we liked it. You know, we recorded it onto a four-track tape machine, and we liked it. And the harmonies were quite sort of wild and improvised. And I thought, oh, we can do this. I had to destroy in Daisy Chainsaw because he wouldn't let me in, you know, to the writing. But I was finding a way in, and so we started writing. And
so you hadn't planned really to reemerge into music; that just sort of came about.
I was always. I just couldn't find my way in. Actually, I had done. We'd done some recordings. We is some friends of mine, and they were, you know, they were good. Again, Derek gave me some more money. He was like, "Yeah, this is good. We can do this." There's more, actually. That I'd been working with lots of different people, but I hadn't quite found it. I hadn't found what it was all. Nice, you know, that's the word, nice, there was just a fire not there.
Can I pause you there just actually? Yeah. There's something that jumps out to me is, do you know in Daisy Chainsaw your accent is way more pronounced than it is in Queen Adrina? Were you aware of that? Did you try to tamp that down or did you exaggerate it?
Which one? Which accent?
It just seemed like a very sort of London accent in Daisy Chainsaw. I mean, like in my head when I sing Love Your Money, I hear it in a very sort of Londonian twang.
Well, you know what? They think it's fair to say that I'll meet the music and figure out what it's asking for.
Yeah, it's pretty snotty. I think it gives it that punky... almost like late 70s feel. That album has a very sort of late 70s feel, but late 70s punk.
Yeah, so my daughter, we talk a lot in different voices and different accents. And, you know, she's not really been exposed to much of what we've done, and she just loves pop music, little music that's made for little girls. And she just sort of says to me, "Well, Mummy, I think you should be an actress." And I think it goes back to the storytelling with the dolls. So maybe there is that. I won't say that I'm an actress, but I'm... It's informing. I don't know how to say this, Chris, really. But there's, I think I'm dancing around something.
It's interesting. It's where I've seen you perform live. I saw you, I think it was around about 2001, 2002. And it does come across as a live persona. I mean, a pretty... I'm not sure if you're aware just quite how intimidating you were, certainly live in that role, but it did also, there was an element of performance to it. There was an element of almost hammer horror at times, like you talk about dolls and a little bit of that, and then there was the very aggressive punk with a little bit of the sort of industrial ministry style, quite sinister darkness to it. It's interesting you were describing the shamanic thing. I mean, did you choose that persona, or you're talking about acting, but or did it, was it just the logical conclusion that you arrived at when you...
Yeah, no, I don't, you know, I'm not choosing a persona. It, you know, you can get to quite dodgy territory very quickly here. I'm relinquishing self. I have, okay. As I said earlier, I have very little sense of self, and my voice changes a lot. And I do, if we talk too much in a certain accent, it sticks around and drives everyone crazy.
So can you do Scottish?
You know, I'm not going to try. It might slip. It might slip in. No.
I hope you're talking Scottish to your family for the next month.
It'd be so bad now I've said all that. Is it channel Scots? No.
It's really interesting that you're saying that, though, that sense of self, because that sort of ties into what you were saying about when you were playing down your own sense of originality. What I was describing earlier, you were quite self-deprecating about your own musical voice, saying that it was an absorbed musical voice from other people, and now, you know, it does seem that you do feel like your identity is quite a small thing in amongst a lot of other noise. Is that fair to say?
I think you've said it a couple of times that I feel that I was influenced by other people. I was really aware of how easy that was to be influenced by other people. So I made a very early decision to try not to be. You know, it's very easy to, mm-hmm. for the obvious ones that you mentioned, Polly Harvey, you know, she's got such distinctive phrasing. You really have to stay away from Polly, because any people can slip into Polly's phrasing so easily, as in Björk, who really sort of changed. She brought in a whole new language, really. So really any singer should turn up and listen to Björk, because she's utterly extraordinary, and then you very much have to walk away. Yes.
So see, with regards to Queen Adrina, obviously it was 4 studio albums plus a fair few other things on the side, including the Jolene single that you put out. Did that start as a B-side?
Yes, it did. Right? Yeah. I consider it a faux pas, quite honestly, because you know that band was getting quite. It got to the bits where people get. We're in our 30s and we have this very fragile relationship, and we're working so hard, and we need it to work. And certainly, at a certain point, you know, there's issues with tax bills and managers that have run off with the loot and all that kind of thing, and suddenly you need it to work, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
need it to work, and that's a really bad position to be in. And
was that quite early on that you felt that pressure?
Well, I'll probably have to excuse myself for getting the timeline mixed up. I'm not sure where Jolene comes in on that timeline. It was after Taxidermy, so
yeah, it was just not long after Taxidermy, the end of the same year, I think.
Yeah, I think for many reasons, well, those ones that I've just sort of highlighted, and knowing how hard it is to keep a band together, and all I can say is being in a position where you need it to work is not the right place to be. Really not the right place to be. That twists things, and it did make things take quite a dark turn, and us having to sort of channel that situation, because I have to find the authenticity within the inauthenticity, if you see what I mean.
I mean, you were still making records, but 8 years later, I'm sure there were some breaks and stuff, but I mean, it seems like you weathered that storm reasonably well, no?
Oh, I don't know. No, it felt that decade was for many other reasons, actually, as well. It had some combustion to it that I think's hard to find. I've heard some bits of, I think the last one that Queen Adrina made. Yeah, Gin, yeah. Where some of that record does it right. It was all recorded live in the studio, yeah. And I was in the control room. The band was set up live. And we were putting that down completely, live takes, which is really the only way I can do it. The energy on that is quite hard to find.
It was pretty warmly received. I mean, there was a couple of writers felt it was one of, like, if not your best work, one of your best works.
I mean, I think there's some pretty rubbish songs on it as well.
For me, I always went back to Drink Me as an album. That was the one that I just thought, even now, has aged incredibly well. Of the catalogue, what are your, you know, personal highlights? What did you feel most positive about, and was there any that you really felt like you'd maybe made a misstep?
Honestly, I don't look back, and I know that's very not very convenient for an interview.
That's okay.
I have to kind of bin it, you know. Once it's done, you'd have to literally wipe the board clean.
That's interesting. You're the second interviewee we've had in a row that has said the exact same thing.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Until, yep, he said once he finishes it, he's like, I don't want to listen to it again.
No. So it is, it's unfortunately, you know, the negativity bias kind of reigns a little bit. I wish it didn't, but I kind of, you know, unfortunately remember the not so good bits. As in just how there were some weird times where Crispin and I ended up in LA with some strange man mixing our record.
You did finally make it. You did actually make it.
Yeah, I got to LA, hey, yeah. But he locked us out of the studio. He didn't want us messing with his mixing, which did not suit us at all. So those were very strange times. I try and think of something, you know, to walk on stage in that band and see a young woman crying her eyes out. It's just such a privilege to be there, to stand there, to lock eyes with that person and do it for her. You know, that's my job, and I'm very grateful for that. I love my work, you know, so...
The videos, I mean, there's still many videos of your Queen Regina performances online for anyone that's curious, and it is the one consistent thing about them as a viewer, is just the empowerment that women obviously felt to come to the front of the stage, because clearly that's an issue in heavy music. A lot of men kind of dominate that territory, and with your band, for some obvious reasons, that wasn't the case. I think it's a really nice thing to see, and it also feels completely organic. It doesn't feel forced. It's an intimidating environment as well, because Katie Jane, whether you like it or not, as a front person, I would have put you up with any of the most ferocious male front people I ever saw in terms of your ability to kind of command the room, irrespective of gender. I can only imagine how exciting that was for a young woman, especially a young woman that wanted to get into music and heavier music, to see that. Yeah, did you get a lot of correspondence from people at the time? Did you get...
There was a void then, wasn't there? I just know that place of meeting those people there. That's all I'm for, Chris, you know that. It's just for that moment. To talk to me or see me out there, the environment is not relevant, really. It's just for that. I'm in danger of overstating it, but for me I'm trying to avoid the word religious, but that's the word I'm trying to avoid, but it is that
we can use it and acknowledge that it's not literal.
It's communion, that's all, you know. It's communion, yeah. And that is my job. It's what I live for. It's the only thing I can do. It's the only thing I'm good for, other than smiling and playing with my kid, you know. And I love it. I love it very much, and I'm so fortunate it found me.
So you overlapped slightly, because Gin, the last Queen Adrian album, came out in 2008, but at this point, I believe, had you already started working with Chris on Ruby Throat?
Yeah, and before that I'd been doing Lala Shwari, which is a very important thing for me and myself. It's just my, because I was living in a studio in a you know, one room with my four track set up on the floor, and that was my sort of sanity, where I couldn't put things together properly in Queen Adrena because it was so very violent, and I had to be violent in response to it, and it was just going up and up, and I felt that there was there was a sort of almost a whoring of the muse, and so I had to use it in that way. I had to make it authentic in that way by embracing that element of it. But that was really, it was really destroying me, and my sanity was to making the four track recordings on just on my own terms. And there's things on there which are some of my favourite things that I've ever done, like Sleep Like Wolves. And Lesions in the Brain, and so I did a couple with my sister actually. And
So Chris Whittingham, Chris is still your partner, your life partner
as
well.
Yeah, so I found him busking on London Underground after I prayed really hard for a cosmic intervention. Yeah, I was face down
sure
on the
if that
floor.
Was one of those,
no,
wow,
no,
I
no,
it was
it's
one
absolutely
of those Wikipedia
true.
Rumors.
No. I don't believe in the power of intention. I know it to be true that if you really will something into being, it's a very simple thing that if you are the thing you want to happen, it happens. So you don't wish for it. You don't pray for it. I did just say I prayed for it, but you are it. So on that day, I embodied the door, the way out, because it was so enmeshed and so codependent, and so I couldn't find my way out of a situation that was very destructive. And on that day I inhabited the door opening utterly, and indeed I heard the guitar coming down the tunnels of the London Underground sounding so utterly beautiful. And I talked to that man, I knocked, tapped on his shoulder, and told him I was a singer and that I would, could I have his phone number because I'd like to work with him.
So between us girls, did the project grow out of the relationship, or the relationship grow out of the project, or was it a bit of both?
The relationship very much grew out of the project. We worked together for 5 years before we were together. So it actually took, I think we worked together for a year, and I believe we started recording bits for the Ventriloquist, and I felt like I was having an affair going into the studio with someone else. I felt it was like a huge betrayal. So it was really hard, that beginning. And then we didn't see each other for a year or something. I went on tour again with Queen Adrena, and we sort of dropped it away. But then I think I called him out of the blue, or he called me out of the blue, and we picked it up and had another go. I think we'd done an open mic somewhere actually, and just thought it was a disaster, Chris and I, really scared ourselves out of existence. Yeah, and then dropped the ball for a year. But then I think he caught me, and we picked it up again. And yes, on the fifth year, we did indeed. I think I left Queen Adrena, and he and I drove to Cornwall, and we began our lives together. Yeah.
So was Chris a seafarer, or did you make one?
He was, because he'd come from He'd come from Hawaii. He'd grown up in Hawaii with a single parent family with his mother, and had lived all over Hawaii. She was in real estate and moved from house to house the way they do in America. And he had taught himself to sail small boats and would sail to school across the bay or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah. Again, I'm a deep believer in magic in its most pure sense. And there he was, sailor, musician, and video filmmaker. And
perfect fit, isn't it?
Recording engineer, everything. And driver, lighting engineer, and just does the sound at the gigs, you know. Because we've learned that if only two people go on tour and they do everything, you can make a very, very modest living. Yeah.
I mean, by all accounts, you and Chris have had a very interesting life together. I know you did, but you have to walk our audience through. You built a boat from scratch, right?
No, we didn't build it.
You didn't build it?
No, we moved on to a canal boat. That was the stepping stone. So we were on the canal boat for the last 2 years in London. And then I got pregnant. That's a long story. It involved cats.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah, you know, it's very much possible. And then some other very extraordinary things happened. We had a sort of very tragedy happen within our family. And from there, we sold the canal boat and bought a sailing boat and went, okay, we're going to do this now because life has to be lived now, not in the future. And we bought the sailing boat, and we then spent a year getting the boat ready. She ended up on the rocks, broke her mooring in a storm, had it craned off the rocks, and then she was very little damage done because she's, if you want the technical details, she's a 1970s sailing boat with a 2-inch fiberglass layup, which means she's incredibly strong. And so she survived her beaching on the rocks, and we went off sailing around the world with Chris's only son and our daughter, who was 1 year old at the time when we left, and sailed around the world for 4 years.
Now, is it true that you had an encounter with a whale?
Yeah, we did, yeah. There's many, you know, but yes, the whale, you're not meant to hit things in the middle of the ocean, you really are not. And we were between the Galapagos Islands and the Marquesas, which really has there's nothing there, there's no shipping lanes, there's no islands, there's just yachts making that journey, and it's 3,500 miles of uninhabited water. And there was a huge crash which brought us all up on deck. The thing that people in our sailing world do not want to hit in the middle of the ocean is shipping containers, and because that does happen on occasion, and that can obviously punch holes in boats, but equally don't want to hit a whale. And if she'd been a lesser found boat, she would have not made it. But we did make it, and to this day we don't know if the whale hit us, but we hit the whale. It would sometimes boats hit sleeping whales, but it's I think about a 40 foot it was bigger than the boat. The boat's 43 feet, so I think it's about a 50 foot whale came up, was rolling behind the boat, so it had gone down under the boat. There was another, we all survived, the whale survived, we survived, but I came up on deck and there was other whales around and dolphins, so I think the whale might have been protecting its young, which they do.
Yeah, it feels like hitting a whale in that stretch of ocean is like walking into a lamppost in the Arctic or something.
Yeah, it's like hitting concrete. Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. And boats go down there a lot because, there's some great literature, actually. I think it's Surviving the Savage Sea. It's a great book written by a Scotsman. I think it's Duke Douglas. I can't remember his second name. It's a beautiful book, beautifully written. But his wooden boat with his family sank there in the 70s by being attacked by killer whales. So he and his two little boys, older son, wife, and adult crew member ended up in a 7-foot fiberglass dinghy for I think it was something like 35 days in the middle of the Pacific Ocean before being picked up by a Korean trawling vessel, I believe. It's an amazing book.
Some of the things that I'm sure, I'm not saying you take them for granted, but some of the things that are maybe not completely mind-blowing, such as you describing seeing whales and dolphins all around the boat, are, you know, they're things that I guess most of us, certainly those of us that have spent much time doing music, will very likely never see in our lives. And some of the stories and anecdotes I've read from your trip, it was a really moving story actually. You said when you were younger you used to watch a star and you were paranoid that it was coming closer to you. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Well, you know, so I turned 12 pretty quickly. So I'm 12, I think I'm 12 to 13. And that is the first star that comes out in the evening. I think it's Venus. That really latched on, or I latched onto it and became so frightened in those exposed, endless waters that was actually honed in on my tiny world with my mother and father and little sister, that was alien craft coming closer and closer. And it just, every night, you know, I couldn't look at it, and then I would force myself or couldn't resist looking at it, and every night I was convinced it was getting closer and closer. And I do think, you know, that's the mind left to wander, that we find things. But the experience of being conscious is so extraordinarily extraordinary. And any of us that pretend to know what that's about is surely delusional. Or, you know, to be conscious of being conscious is, think about it, you know, all politics, everything just falls to the ground like sugar.
I think if you've clearly had time as well, given the time at sea, minus all the kind of noise, the noise pollution, the light pollution, just the attention pollution of being in cities, and to muse on those things.
Well, I think it sets up, well, again, it's me talking about something I don't know about anything about, but it sets up neural pathways, I think. Well, that's one way of explaining the unexplainable.
It was really interesting watching you talk about timelessness as well, because I'm very mindful when we're asking you about the chronology of things. You've been raised for a large part of your life in a situation where, you know, whilst night and day goes by, time doesn't pass in necessarily the same way. I mean, you spoke about when you were younger, you couldn't have told what era you were in when you were at sea.
But that's how it is at sea. There are no reference points. And so much of our reality, I believe, is sprung out of the collective agreement or collective consciousness. Really, I always want to backtrack out of this bit of conversation because I cannot say it is true, but it's my way of explaining the unexplainable. With no reference points, who are we?
But that's a really interesting. I think I understand as well that you can maybe offer anyone listening some advice on what fish not to eat to avoid neurotoxins near a barrier reef.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the barrier reef, but I know about that you're better not eat any kind of shellfish on the other side of Nuku Hiva in the Marquesas. Yes, very, very poisonous. Friends, became very, very sick. Yeah, no, you do not want to get that. Yeah, that is a very, very frightening form of poisoning.
Can you be vegan at sea? David's vegan, and I don't know if he's cut out for it.
Can you be vegan at sea? Yes, you can, but you'll have to take a lot of tinned beans and TVP or soya, dried soya products. Yes, you can. I do eat fish because I'm prepared to kill it. I don't like to kill it, but I am prepared to do it, so I will eat it. And I don't know if I think it's fair, but I'm prepared to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I have done it. So I'm not prepared to eat a chicken or a cow. I will not kill that.
But if you saw one at sea, you might consider it.
No, I will not.
I mean, if I saw a chicken or a cow in the middle of the ocean,
when you have a chump.
I think it's pretty special. So, as I understand it, you went ashore to record. Is that right? I mean, you've done three albums with Ruby Throat, and you're on to Liar Flare now. But is that true that you were going ashore to try and record stuff you've been working on?
We had things that we had to do. So, in regards to other people in our family, so we did indeed come ashore for. It ended up being 4 years, and finished the Baby Darling Tapuro album, and then have done the Geiger Counter Lyre Flower album in a Cornish cottage in the sitting room. Yeah. Hey, Elijah! So we just done that, and now we've finished that, and we've completed on the family things that we had to attend to, and we have gone back onto our boat day before yesterday.
And so you're going to cast off full time, yeah?
Yeah, we will. We're going this year, but now we will go in April next year and live that life. It makes sense to us. It's brutal, but in the right way. It's good for the mind and the body.
Just in terms of Geiger Counter, I know a lot of that was improvised.
Sky!
It's certainly very different from the Lyre Flower stuff from Ruby Throat. So, sorry.
Yeah.
Did you know that you were making a different project before you made the music, or did that come out afterwards?
Well, post Queen Adrena, I just had a drums embargo, and I had to make it quiet. I had to, and so, but. By the time we were here, and that's really hard on Chris, the musician he is, but he went with it. And I was reducing things all the time for him, I'd sort of reduced it to it's five string. It's like a ukulele, but it's a miniature guitar, which got a beautiful tone, which came on much of Baby Darling Tapuro. But on this one, we just went, okay, there was something coming up. And it was really clear in my writing books. I began writing Lyre Flower over and over again. I felt an energy change, just a switch up. And we just made a decision to just let it be anything. We knew we wanted to make some noise. I knew that was coming in. Like it had just arrived, that door had just opened again, that sort of, I guess it was nearly a decade of everything being held down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and I was meditating really deeply and really enjoying, I've always done this, but I took it really seriously, and I was meditating for an hour in the morning. And as I was coming out of the meditation, where my brain doesn't recognize who she is, I was writing from there, kind of automatic writing. And from there, having the sheets printed, I was not look back at the sheets for maybe 3 months and make sure I don't. So I've got a complete separation from that automatic writing. and then have, when we're improvising, have the sheets around me and allow the words from those from that automatic writing to pick me. So it's coming from lots of different sheets, lots of different sessions. And I found that one of the most productive ways to write, and I'm sort of really happy to talk about that because I think it is, I kind of want people to know about that and try that out. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting way. It became very prescient to everything that's happened. We recorded that record mainly last year. We finished it this year. All that writing was done last year. And there's something when you sort of reach outside of your sort of, again, using words that I don't really understand, but of reaching out of the front brain, frontal cortex, when you use different parts of the brain to write from. I think it's, I can call it a form of channeling, but I'd really like to get out of my own way. I always have done, easy for me, because I have very little sense of self. And, you know, there's the catalyst of being on the terror of being on stage, all those things do that to me, and I absorb the voices or become the voices, whatever it is that I can call channeling, and that's my work, you know. That Live Flower record was very gratifying to me. I feel that of all the things that I've done in my life, I managed to get out of the way enough. And the relationship for Chris and I is enmeshed that way that makes it more than the sum of its parts rather than destroying the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, previously I always did the one step forward, two steps backwards, and everything was so hard earned. So those good moments in Queen Adrena were so fought for, and so I had to pay such a high price for them. But this relationship, this enmeshment, this stepping aside was so filling, making more than, just so gratifying. I like it.
Well, Katie Jean, I've had so much of your time, more than we expected. Thank you very much for that. You've been really generous with us.
Listen, I'm really sorry to monologue so much, and I've
absolutely brilliant so far. Honestly, I'm really looking forward to editing this. I think it will.
Okay, well, you're going to have to edit quite hard, I think, because I think I really hope it's not too boring.
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. There's one more thing we need to ask you, Ian.
Yeah.
It's a little favour that we ask all of our interviewees. So in our normal episodes, when we pick an album, we usually try and connect it to an individual. We call it the Nexus, and we try and find interesting links through history and people and things like that. So without any rehearsal, we want you to pick any person. They can be a fictional character or a real person, just any person that comes into your mind. And for our next album, the challenge is that we have to try and connect the album to those people. So there you go. We've sprung it on you.
Well, the first person that came to mind was Ligeti, but that maybe that's not, does that, because Ligeti's composer, so that doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, no, that's perfect.
We'll you make can it pick work. Anyone you want. If that's who you want to pick, you
should
can.
Should we stick
can...
with Ligeti? And then there's my someone I'm devoted to is Anais Nin.
Oh, good choice. Well, I tell you what, we can put Anais Nin in the pot, and that means it will get drawn at a later date, and we'll do Ligeti next week instead.
Okay, all right.
That's amazing.
Well, as Chris said, KJ, that was brilliant. I was rapt with attention throughout, and also you stole all the questions, Chris, as you did in the last episode. So
that's what I do.
I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much, for you all, the three of you, for your time and your interest. I really.
No, it's been great. I just want to say that I really do love the Geiger Counter record. I've been listening to it all weekend, and yeah. I'm just really excited to hear what you do next, and thank you for coming on.
Yeah, as I said, seeing you 18 years ago, I think it was, I saw you live, and it's a real thrill to be able to have this chat with you, Katie Jean. So,
I'm so grateful. Thank you, the three of you, so much. I really, really appreciate it very much.
And safe travels.
Yes, we'll be in touch, hey?
Look out for the whales.
Yeah, you too, look out for the whales.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.